The quiet of winter has settled over Arcola Mills. The only sound here is the crunch of snow as I walk down the hill from the road to the mansion, home of the Arcola Mills Historic Foundation. Beyond the white mansion lies the St. Croix River, a smooth white ribbon that forms a bend as it passes the historic mansion. I've come to get a close look at this mansion that overlooks the river, north of Stillwater, and that has witnessed so much history, so many stories.
Welcome! Glad to have you here.
I'm Yvette Oldendorf, and I am the Vice President of Arcola Mills.
This is the house that the Maurers built. In fact, I like to say, this is the house that the White Pines built.
It was more than 160 years ago, before Minnesota was even a territory, that brothers John and Martin Maurer built this house, the first large house along the St. Croix. Like others before and after them, they came from the east to make their fortunes, attracted by the seemingly endless stands of white pine and a river to transport those pine logs on. Here at Arcola, the brothers discovered springs that would provide power for their sawmill, a mill that brought more people to this spot to work. Brent Peterson of the Washington County Historical Society talked to me about those early immigrants to the St. Croix Valley.
Yeah, the initial settlements were done by New Englanders. You have people who settled Stillwater were from the New Brunswick or the Maine area. And same with the Maurers, same with a lot of the other pioneers, because they knew logging. Up in Maine, there were a lot of lumberjacks, a lot of lumbering, and they came here because it was such a virgin territory of timber. And they were just in a utopia, probably, because of all the great stands of white pine.
A is for axes, as well you all know, and B are the boys that can swing them also.
But these loggers weren't the first people by any means to be attracted to the St. Croix River. Rivers have always been important places, transportation routes, sources of water and food, sometimes sacred places. A trip to the National Park Service's St. Croix River Visitors Center in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin, gave me some feel for the long history of the valley.
I'm Jean Sheppy. I'm the National Park Service historian here. We know there were people here early on by archaeological records, primarily from what's called the Woodland Period. So this is before any named tribes existed in this area, and we only know them by the pottery and the spear points and arrowheads and stuff that they left behind. But we know they camped and lived along the river. When the first Europeans came, the people they encountered here were the Dakota and Ojibwe. And over time, the Ojibwe started moving south, and the Dakota started moving kind of south and west, and then eventually both of them wound up giving up the land east of the Mississippi River.
It didn't take long after the Treaty of 1837 for Easterners to start making their way to this area. For the next 75 years or so, logging companies and lumber mills in the valley provided white pine timber that built St. Louis and points west. The first attempt at building a mill came from officers and their relatives at Fort Snelling, but this first milling venture in the area wasn't a success.
In 1837, when the treaty was signed, the people closest to here were at Fort Snelling, so they're the ones who made the initial land grabs. They came up here because of the waterfall, the rapids that was here at this location in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin. They made the land claim here because they figured this had the best water power that could power a mill. Unfortunately, these gentlemen knew nothing about sawmills. And so even though they established the first land claim and had probably the best location on the river, the first sawmill to be established was actually a marina on St. Croix.
Soon after the mills started at Marine on St. Croix and Stillwater in the early 1840s, John and Martin Maurer arrived in the area and set to work. Martin was listed as a foreman in what was probably a logging camp at a place called Fish Lake in the 1844-45 season. The following year, he and some partners bought land 7 miles north of Stillwater. They called this spot Arcola. Arcola boasted several springs, an attractive power source for an aspiring mill owner, and no doubt the reason for their interest in this spot. There, Martin built a sawmill powered by one of these springs. The mill began operation in 1847, the third or fourth mill along the St. Croix. Meanwhile, Martin's older brother John had spent 2 years working in St. Croix Falls for the St. Croix Falls Manufacturing Company before moving to Stillwater. The story goes that he floated his wife Gracia and their two children down the St. Croix on a raft made of the lumber that he would use to build their home, the second frame house in Stillwater. After a few years of working as a millwright for the John McCusick Company there, he joined his brother Martin at Arcola. Unlike those investors from Fort Snelling, the Mower brothers actually knew what they were doing. In 1853, they added a steam-powered sawmill, and the mill continued in operation until the late 1800s. But the mill wasn't the only thing they built at Arcola. In 1847, they also built the mansion. Brent Peterson.
It's on the National Register of Historic Places. It was a Greek revival. It was a style that you would see up in the New England area.
The mansion has been restored, but it still bears the marks of its logging history. Yvette Oldendorf showed me the pine flooring in the room that had been John Mower's office.
See those marks down over there when the light shines on them? They're darker. You can see them on these wonderful wood floors. Those are the cleat marks from the lumberman who would come up on the deck or the porch here and into the house. And this was the office where they would be meeting with John Mower.
The mansion soon became the center of a little community.
Arcola became quite the small little town with blacksmith shop, the mill. There was a grocery store, a confectionery type of thing. Several homes, including the Mower's very large estate that was there and is still there today.
The Mower brothers turned their talents to pursuits besides their sawmill. John was active in politics, serving first in the territorial legislature, then as a supervisor in Marine, and in 1874 as a representative in the state legislature. It was later reported in the Stillwater Gazette that he had no taste for politics or public life, and it was only at the urgent solicitation of friends that he consented to allow his name to appear as a candidate at that time. He was well-liked in the area. He must have been. He won a majority, even though he was running on the Democratic ticket in a district that was mostly Republican.
They named a county after John Mower, Mower County, where Austin and Albert Lee exist today. The Mower County is named for a person who has never been there and is from Arcola.
John's wife, Gracia, was also well-respected. Martin, on the other hand, was known as an eccentric, but he was also a shrewd businessman. And many of his business ventures grew out of his base on the St. Croix River. Starting in the 1850s and continuing until his death in 1890, Martin operated a boat building business at Arcola. He built several passenger steamboats and pile driver boats for the St. Croix Boom Company, but he also wanted to provide river transportation between Taylor's Falls and Stillwater in the winter.
One of the more famous boats that he created was a winter boat, the Queen Pajuk. The Queen, would go up and down the St. Croix River on the ice in the 1870s, about from 1877 to about 1880. It was not a huge success, but it was said that it could go from Stillwater to Arcola in about a half an hour on the ice. They called it the Great Grasshopper because it jumped as the spikes of the wheels kept digging into the ice.
More important was his investment in the St. Croix Boom Company. The boom was critical to the logging companies up and down the St. Croix.
The St. Croix boom was a place on the St. Croix River where the logs were stopped. Every company on the St. Croix or its tributaries would use a symbol that they would mark their logs with, like branding a cow. They would brand the logs with their company mark. The logs would all get dumped into the river at one time in the spring, so at the boom is where the logs were stopped. They were identified. And they were measured, and of course, they were taxed. And then they were rafted into what is called brills, or little rafts, and then they were pushed down to where the logs would be milled into lumber. It could be in Stillwater. It could have been, you know, down as far as St. Louis, Missouri.
It's hard to imagine today how the St. Croix would have looked in the spring, with the winter's harvest of logs floating downriver. The scale of the industry was huge and sometimes exceeded the capacity of the river to handle the logs.
The problem was that when there was a lot of companies logging on the tributaries, the logs would fill the rivers, and where the river would narrow, and if it was a dry spring, the logs would jam into the riverbed, and then they would just start backing up. And that happened several times in the 1880s, and some of the log jams became so big, it took 6 or 7 weeks to break them, and they had to use dynamite. To fix this problem, they built the Nevers Dam north of St. Croix Falls and Taylor's Falls, and that seemed to help. And after the 1880s, there were no significant log jams anymore.
By the late 1800s, change was on the horizon. What had seemed like an inexhaustible resource in the beginning was finally depleted after several decades of unrestrained exploitation.
Well, the lumber industry on the St. Croix really, it hit its peak in the 1890s. Billions of feet of sawed logs would run through the St. Croix boom every year. But people could see the end coming soon, and by 1914, the last log went through the St. Croix boom.
The end of the logging industry brought changes to the communities up and down the river that had been built on it, and Arcola was no exception. John Mower had died in 1879 and Martin in 1890. Gracia continued to live at the mansion until her death in 1904, and the Arcola community that had grown up around the mansion declined slowly.
The mill itself eventually just stopped by the 1860s, 1870s, and the people started moving away. So all that was left was the house, remnants of the mill, and a few other miscellaneous buildings.
As we stood on the deck of the mansion, Yvette Oldendorf took me back in time, imagining what Arcola was like in those prosperous mill years.
Look out and you can see this wonderful river, the St. Croix, and if you can think back, you at one time could see those logs just going right down that river. But also, when from this vantage point, if you look over here now to the left of us, you'll see up that coulee, the town would go there. And now, do you see any traces?
Nothing.
Nothing. Isn't that interesting? It's just a wonderful little nature coulee. And if you sit here quietly, you can hear the stream.
Arcola was pretty much forgotten for a few decades, and nature began reclaiming the land. It wasn't until the mid-1930s that Arcola and the mansion were rediscovered, by accident, by a couple named Henry and Catherine Van Meyer. Christopher Stein, superintendent of the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway.
They were on a fern hunting expedition. They discovered this place, and they saw the historic mansion, and they fell in love with it. So they purchased it and used it kind of as their retreat from Stillwater.
The Van Meyers were a fascinating couple. Henry was a doctor in Stillwater until the 1970s. There are still many Dr. Van Meyer babies in the St. Croix Valley, and Catherine was a great supporter of the arts. Both of them loved spending their summers living in the mansion at Arcola. Mary Gilstrom got to know the Van Meyers in the 1950s when she was still in high school, and she was occasionally out at Arcola while working for Dr. Van Meyer.
I began working with Dr. Henry Van Meyer at the age of 15. I knew Catherine very well. Catherine was a highly intelligent, beautiful woman. She was from Marion, Virginia, and she had a sister, and she married Sherwood Anderson. She was very interested in the arts and the sciences. She was beautiful. She could have passed for a movie star.
With the Van Meyers, Arcola began a new phase as a place of refuge from the hustle and bustle of the modern world. Neil Krieger has served on the board at Arcola Mills and continues to work on the Natural Resources Committee there.
Arcola is one of those spots that just draws people in. You know, it's on the St. Croix River, so you've always got the motion of the river. As you drive into Arcola or walk in, you go down and into a deep forest and deep ravines where there's springs, natural springs. It's sort of a timeless place.
Arcola's location, nestled next to a bend in the St. Croix, made it a perfect setting for artists and others who are inspired by the natural beauty here. Early on, the Van Meyers decided to share with others, and especially artists. Catherine's sister and brother-in-law, Eleanor, and the writer Sherwood Anderson visited often, and Eleanor's diary recorded one occasion when Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas visited in 1934. But it was local artists who really benefited from the Van Meyer generosity.
You know, it's kind of interesting. The outbuildings, or the cabins, as we call them, have been part of Arcola's history probably since the 1920s or 30s when the Van Meyers owned the property. The Van Meyers were very nature people, but they were also artists. Mrs. Van Meyer was an artist and recognized the need to provide housing for budding artists and students. And even some of the guys that I went through high school with stayed in these cabins. One is an old houseboat. Another is an old barge from the river called the Wanigan. Another is called the Gypsy Wagon. It's an old wagon on steel wheels. And another is part of the old mill at Arcola. And so many of them were used up through the 1960s as summer residences for artists and people interested in nature and whatnot.
Of course, the mansion itself had fallen into some disrepair in the years it had been left empty. So besides adding the cabins to the property, the Van Meyers had to do some work on the house to make it livable. They added on to the original 1847 house, but found that they couldn't quite reclaim everything from Mother Nature, in particular the bee room on the upper level.
Bees had built between the inner wall and this beautiful lumber wood exterior and had their combs, their honeycombs in there. So they did everything they could to rid themselves of these creatures. With absolutely no luck, they would come back. They'd get rid of them, they'd smoke them out, and they'd come back again. So finally, the story goes that one day, Catherine went up to that room. She was tired of these bees there. And she shouted into the room, "All right then, this is your room, but the rest of the house now belongs to us." She shut the door and sealed it up. And apparently, a great era of coexistence began.
Like his wife, Dr. Van Meyer was a supporter of the arts, but he also had a busy career as a doctor with an office in Stillwater. Times were much different when he was practicing medicine, and today it is hard to imagine a doctor hiring a high school girl to work in his office. But back in the 1950s, Mary Gilstrom simply applied for the job.
All he said to me is he was looking for somebody that could type, and I could type, and he was looking for somebody actually to do insurance papers and to take the names of the patients and get their charts out and have them on his desk when he came in. And I started down there, and I loved it. It was just so interesting to me because he was so kind to everybody, and he was so generous. I mean, he was paid in chickens and eggs from the farmers. At that time, the office calls were $2.50. And if you didn't have the $2.50 and you had a dollar and a quarter, the bill was paid in full.
Imagine being a teenager and learning to take x-rays by practicing on the doctor's dog or assisting him with patients. It's no wonder that the memories are strong after more than 50 years.
I learned an awful lot of things from Dr. Van Meyer. We did all of our own x-rays and we did our blood work. He was very interested in mental health. In the later years when I was there, he delivered a good share of his babies under hypnosis. He had a very small hand and he did beautiful suture work. If you came to him, you rarely left with a scar after he sutured you up because he was very clever. And I do remember there was a gentleman on Arcola Road. He was washing windows. He fell through a big plate glass window head first. And they brought him in with towels wrapped around his head. We sutured him up. I bet I was there 2 hours with him. And I never thought the poor man would ever walk outside again because his face was, it was bad. And the man never had a scar after it.
Henry Van Meyer made up his own prescriptions and made house calls on snowshoes in the winter. He treated people from the jail, the residents of the rest home at Pine Point, the people who were on the county on welfare. And Mary doesn't remember him ever taking a vacation. But however busy he was with his practice, and Catherine was with her arts activities and her bridge club, they were devoted to each other, their two children, and their summer retreat at Arcola.
He dearly loved Catherine. He called her Angel. She adored him. They were together all the time. They treasured each other, and they were very happy together.
Henry Van Meyer died in the 1970s, and Catherine died in the early 1990s. It was thanks to Catherine that the mansion and surrounding 50 acres have been preserved for the future. Yvette Oldendorf.
She designated it to be turned over to a nonprofit organization so that the public could enjoy it. And she saw it as a place for the arts, and it is now run so that people can come and be exposed to some of those wonderful things that she liked here.
The 50-acre estate that surrounds the mansion and stretches out along the river is a treasure in itself. Neil Krieger.
Arcola sort of went into a time capsule. Nothing happened, maybe from 1910 till the 1930s or 40s when the Van Meyers bought the property. And so it wasn't developed, it wasn't split up. It's still a 50-acre parcel that is very unique, especially so close to Stillwater and right on the St. Croix River. Because it wasn't developed, many of the trees are several hundred years old. I know that some of the oak trees there are approaching 250 years old. It also has been protected from any kind of cultivation. And so on the forest floor, there's many unique plants that have been identified. And it's important that we are careful how we develop the land and with trails to make sure that those native plants aren't disturbed. A number of years ago, Arcola worked with the DNR. Because of the unique natural setting, both parties realized that it should be protected forever. In order to do that, then an easement was drawn up. Once this document was prepared, the DNR purchased a conservation easement then from Arcola. No matter, you know, what happens to Arcola, there's still this conservation easement that has to be followed, no matter who owns that land. And so the land will always be protected into the future.
Of course, the land had felt the impact of the logging era, and that showed up in the absence of white pines on the property. This absence of white pines made me wonder what the impact of logging had been along the whole river. What did it look like at the end of the logging era? Was the land totally denuded? How had the oak trees at Arcola managed to survive so long? To answer those questions, I turned to Jean Sheppy, the National Park Service historian at St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin.
Most of your trees were gone. The early logging phase, all they wanted were pine. So they didn't care about, say, oak trees or cottonwoods or elms or things like that because they don't float on the river. You can't transport them by river. So you still had some other types of trees in existence, but where there were large stands of pine, that would have all been cut. And if other trees had gotten in their way, they would have been cut. You also were having some fires sweep through the area because of the slash piles left by the logging. And so some of the area would have been burnt. It wouldn't have been totally bare, but it would definitely look a lot different than it does today.
My visit to the National Park Service also clarified some other questions that came up as I was learning more about Arcola. What did it mean that the St. Croix River had been designated as a wild and scenic riverway? How had this affected Arcola? Would the peace and tranquility one finds at Arcola be threatened in the future by development nearby? Chris Stein.
The National Scenic Riverway is a specially protected river in America, protected by the 1968 Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. What Congress stated in the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act was that there needed to be a system of clean, free-flowing rivers to balance those other rivers that were used for commercial navigation and rivers that had been dammed. Mondale and Gaylord Nelson were co-sponsors of the legislation. Mr. Mondale is still a great fan and supporter of the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway. This is his river. And we're very lucky that they were involved because, you know, when the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act was passed, the St. Croix was one of the first of eight rivers in America protected.
And the health of the river in 1970? Was there any lasting damage from the logging boom that ended some 60 years earlier?
The river was considered one of the cleanest rivers in the Midwest as it is today, and that was one of the pluses for preserving it. It has a dam here at St. Croix Falls, a hydroelectric dam, but otherwise it's free-flowing. It was never an extremely polluted river. The towns along the river were always small. And so even though they would have been dumping into the river, it wasn't like having a huge city along the bank. So this was a pretty clean, healthy river in the 60s.
Neil Krieger talked about the conservation easement on the property at Arcola that prevents the land from being developed. But I learned that the scenic riverway is also managed partially through easements, in this case scenic easements. Chris Stein.
The riverway itself, the combined lower river or the upper river, it's over 90,000 acres in size, but only about 25% of that land is actually owned by the federal government. The other 75% is managed some other way. A large percentage of that, probably over 30%, is managed by scenic easement. The United States government purchased the development rights from all of these property owners, and all the government asked was that you don't build things on there that would not be appropriate for, you know, a wild and scenic river. Our job is to protect the view from the river. So when people, you know, canoe down the river, they kind of see this wild landscape.
Arcola now has its place in this regional preservation effort. It's a spot where people can come to hear the burbling of the spring, watch the changing of the seasons, and be soothed by the movement of the river. And as Catherine Van Meyer had envisioned, it is also a place for people to enjoy the arts. Recent programs have featured woodworking, printmaking, photography, poetry readings, as well as bird watching and hikes along the trails to discover the unique ecology of Arcola. Arcola is a special place, a place that enchants new visitors and keeps old friends returning again and again to their favorite spots. Neil Krieger.
I think my most favorite spot is right above the main spring, which is high on the bluff, just west of the mansion. I love hills and I love mountains, and so this is the closest thing to mountains that I can come to, and it's one of the highest points on the property. The second spot I like is just not too far from the mansion itself, and it's where two springs come together, and if you stand in the right spot and they're flowing over the rocks, it's like hearing the water in stereo.
Arcola Mills has seen centuries of change, but endures today as a witness to the rich history of the St. Croix River. This is Bobby Scott for KFAI. Miniculture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.